Hi, and welcome to the Crime Pod. I'm Sam.
And I'm Caitlin.
So this week I am going, I'm going back, but not too far back. I'm going back to like the 40s and 50s, so bear with me with this one. Now, I found it while I was doing research for, you know, when we just kind of look and see what other cases we can do. And I thought this one's very interesting because I'll need your opinion at the end, Caitlin, whether or not you think this person is a serial killer or innocent. So this week, I'm going to tell you the story of Dr. John Adams. So first, before I begin, we just would like to talk about the merch and say thank you so much. It's still mind-boggling, like, just yeah. That people are buying stuff with our logo on it, so honestly, thank you. If you still want something as well, just go onto the website. It's Inch Embroidery, which is based in West
Wales.
Yeah,
we have
it
tagged in our show notes.
Yes, and so she is like a local supplier as well. It's not like we're going away to America or anything like that. So also,
we've seen a couple of different initially, because the merch that we got was the embroidered ones, so that's all we kind of like were able to recommend, was the embroidered ones, which do look amazing. However, I've started to see some people get the printed ones because they are, I think, a couple of pounds cheaper depending on the item, and they still look amazing. They look really, really good.
100%, and I was very pleasantly surprised, so thank you very much for that as well. But it's just wild, so thank you.
Yeah, we kind of said to the woman, like, oh, do you know, we'll launch it on this day and whatever, and I was like, we sound like total idiots, especially if nobody buys it. So I was like, imagine she's like, hi, that's it launched and you've had no orders, and we're like, okay. But yeah, I think we had loads of orders come in the first day, so we really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. But anyway, we'll stop wasting your time. So, and we will get to why you're actually here. So, Caitlin, have you heard of Dr. Adams before?
I haven't. Are we talking, is he English, Scottish?
He was born in Ireland, but he's based in England.
Oh, no, I have not. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, sit tight because it's quite an interesting one. As well, I'll say when we start kind of going into it and things, was he the first Harold Shipman? Who knows?
That's a statement.
Mm-hmm. Now, I could have to retract this statement by the end because you could be like, Samantha, you're talking utter shit. So bear with me. You might feel the same way or you might not. Okay. So John Adams, he was born into quite a highly religious family. Of Plymouth Brethren, and he was born in Ireland. Now, his father, Samuel, he was actually a preacher as well in the local congregation, but also his profession, he was a watchmaker. He also had a passionate interest in cars, which he then would pass on this interest to his son, John. So again, great interest, might be relevant later on, might not be. Now, Samuel, he was 39 years old when he married John's mother, Ellen, and she was 30, and they were in Northern Ireland, and that was in 1896. John was her first son that was born in 1899, followed by a brother, William, in 1903. In 1914, Adams's father, he sadly actually died of a stroke. 4 years later, William, his brother, then died of influenza. There was an influenza pandemic at
Jesus.
That time. Yep. And that was, you know, one of those times it's like you.
What is influenza? Sorry if this is absolute tripping you up, but what is it?
I think it's just the flu. I say just the flu. It's the flu.
All right, Dr. Riley, thank you.
Now, I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it's the flu, like severe flu. And as well, we're in the early 1900s. It's like, you will die of the flu.
Fair, yeah, I forget there's no like paracetamol kind of out there. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's tons of stuff, and again, Victorian times, we've spoken in cases before, they are not afraid to give you high doses of like mental
you've
stuff.
Got the flu, that's fine, we will have to open you up and do surgery without anesthetic, sorry.
Exactly. But no, the flu, it was a huge thing, killer back then, and it still is today, just not as severe.
Yeah, well, get your flu
maybe
jab,
it
can
is.
People
Yes, 100%.
Although I will say, I've never had the flu until I got the flu shot.
Oh, really?
I never had the flu jab, and then obviously when the COVID jags came around, I was like, I'll get my flu one. Got the flu.
Well, it does inject you with the flu, I guess. So maybe it was just like, yeah. I've never, I don't think, had the flu. Well, I've never had the flu jab, but I have had swine flu and COVID. And you
no,
know,
you've
swine.
Not, have you?
I had swine flu
Shut.
Back in the day.
Shut up. No, you didn't.
Yeah.
I don't know this about you.
Mm-hmm. My dad and I had it.
Enough.
Yeah.
Actually,
it was
can't believe I
mental.
Didn't know this about you.
It was severe back then. It was,
I
we kind of hung
it.
Out in the living room, and my mum and brother kind of just got on with their lives. We were
oh my
just
God.
Like dying.
My dad just oinking occasionally.
Exactly.
That is honestly, I can't believe I didn't know that about you. No, my mum, I remember when I was younger, obviously, like, do you know when you'd have the cold and you'd like, no, it's the flu. And my mother said to me, like, Caitlin, you will know if it's the flu. And I was like, all right, okay, like, what was that about? Trust me, you will know if it's the flu. I thought I'd died.
And you're dramatic at the best of times, so.
I was honestly lying there. And do you know when, like, I remember getting up and, like, going to make a cup of tea. So I got out of my bedroom. This is when we lived in our old flat as well. So I got out, like, got up from bed, walked the 10 steps to the kitchen, put the kettle on, and I actually couldn't. I was too weak to wait for the kettle to finish. I just went back to bed. I was like, it doesn't matter. That is
depressing.
Honestly. Yeah, so you'll know. But that was nothing compared to your swine flu.
No, no. Every illness is legit. Don't you worry. But
thank
no.
you.
Yeah. The flu, it is severe. So do take care if you ever have it. Now, going back to Adams, he went to Queen's University in Belfast at the age of 17. And his goal was to become a doctor. He was seen as quite like a lone wolf and things like that by his lecturers. And due to partly an illness, which was probably tuberculosis, but there's no confirmations of this, he actually ended up missing a year of studies. And so then he graduated in 1921, but he didn't qualify for an honours degree. In 1921, Arthur Randall Short offered him a position as assistant houseman at Bristol Royal Infirmary. Adams spent a year there, but he didn't really have much success. And then on Short's advice, he applied for a job as a general practitioner in a Christian practice in Eastbourne over in England. Now, he arrived.
People back then jumped around jobs a lot, eh?
Oh, but you could. It's like even back when our mums,
I feel like there wasn't
well,
like CVs or references or anything.
Yeah, you get like a good word and say.
See,
so,
my
so.
Mum's wasn't very like that. If you looked at her LinkedIn, she was a dedicated woman. She'd stay somewhere for like 18 years.
Oh, right, fair enough. Whereas it's like, if you need a job, you could just, she could have just left it and walked into another one. Unlike nowadays, where it's like you need to complete a 25-page essay on why we should hire you, and then we won't read it, and we won't even tell you you don't have the job.
Well, I think like, that's, literally. But I think as well, like, my mum left school, and like, you know, my dad left school, everyone left school, and just kind of walked into employment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whereas now, if you said, oh, I'm actually not going to go to college or uni, I want to go and find a job, that's like, that's why schools are a bit like, because you can't just walk into standard life nowadays and be like, hello, like, I'd like to work here.
Yeah, no, it's a rigorous process. Like, I remember I left school and went straight into a job, but for one of the jobs I had to, one of the jobs for the actual job I got, I had to start it during our kind of study leave period before the, like, the sixth year ball and the sixth year leaving ceremony and stuff. So I was working,
I remember
before we
that,
practically
yeah.
left school. It's depressing as hell. I do not recommend. But I do.
But again,
time.
It was that
it's
actually
hard.
Because you then could find a job. Whereas if you had said to them, no, actually, I'm still at school, the chance would have gone.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. And again, that was 10 years ago. So it's now still extremely difficult. It's just mental. But again,
yeah,
some
totally.
People don't have the choice. I was like, I don't want to go to uni or college. Well, if you don't get a job, you're not staying under this roof. Yeah.
Love. But I like, I've been looking at like for work and stuff, not for me, but for like different college courses and like uni courses and like what the entry requirements are like nowadays. And even for like the courses that I would go on to study, even like the more practical subjects, the entry requirements are so much more than we had. So actually, you're talking like you're kind of, do your subjects that you didn't really need as much stuff. Like everything now is needing like the equivalent of like higher math and English and all this stuff. And you're like, Jesus, like, that's so difficult. I didn't do higher math.
No.
Absolutely not. And you know, and I was fine. I'm still fine. I mean, I'm thick as shit with numbers, but like I've managed to get on with life as much as I can. Whereas like to not even get into uni now to do a course that has nothing to do with maths because you don't have maths is brutal.
Yeah, no, it's ridiculous. There has to be a big change up, and yeah, we're obviously not the ones that are going to be able to change that. But
I know, I was
in
like,
the
enough
future,
saving the world, back to this potential case.
Yeah, sorry for the digression, but Adams arrived in Eastbourne in 1922, where he lived with his mother and his cousin, Floris Henry. In 1929, he borrowed £2,000 from a patient, William Mohood, and bought a house in Trinity Trees, which was quite, you know, an area that he, affluent area that he wanted to live in. Now, Adams would frequently invite himself to the Mohood's residence at meal times, and he would even bring his mum and cousin along. He also began charging items to their accounts at local stores without their permission. Mrs. Mohood would later describe Adams to the police as a real scrounger, which, I mean, it screams it when you just invite yourself for dinner all the time. Now,
yeah, that is bad crack.
When Mr. Mohood finally, well, not finally died, that sounds awful, but when he died in 1949, he was aged 89. So you would think, okay, this is going to be, I'm going to stick with the wife. He's done so much for me. I've borrowed money from him to buy a house. He's given me dinners. He's given my mum and cousin dinners. Like, I've actually went and bought stuff on their accounts and they've not, like, made me pay them back. But he visited his wife uninvited, took a 22-carat gold pen from her bedroom dressing table, saying that he wanted something of her husband's to remember him by. And he never visited her again. Remember him by a photo. Like, a 22-carat gold pen ain't gonna remind
him. I'm more confused if someone's actually got that in their bedside unit, to be fair. But, yeah, that's not gonna bring
that
up.
Write a lot of letters back in the day, don't they? Like, they love a pen. Like a Mont Blanc. People still love a Mont Blanc.
I don't know what that
is. Not me. It's a type of pen. Very expensive. I wouldn't be able to write. I'm a big person. Like, the fancier the pen,
I love a biro.
Writing. Yeah, yeah. Like, I get, you know, like, calligraphy and all that. No, my hand just shakes. I'm like, oh, it's too stressful. Anyway, gossip regarding Adams's unconventional methods started by, like, the mid-1930s while he was being in the doctor's practice. In 1935, he received the first of many kind of anonymous postcards that were saying that, what are you doing here? This is quite, like, unconventional methods here. You should maybe watch out. And he admitted this in a newspaper interview in 1957. But back in 1935, it was, in fact, a time that Dr. Adams inherited £7,385 from a patient, Mrs. Matilda Whitten, and her whole estate.
Are people inheriting things from patients?
So many times. We hear that as well with Harold Shipman and tons of people. Patients were giving away their estates to their doctors. Like, back in the day, there was this huge trust of, like, this people, these are important people, these are people of power, they care, like, we have a relationship with our doctor. Albeit back then you could literally probably just rock up at their door and get an appointment, but there was a huge kind of, like, trust within that community. And as well, he got that much from her. Her whole estate was around £11,400. Like, so that's practically almost
that's
all
mental.
Of her estate. Mm-hmm. Now, the will, it was contested as well by her relatives, because, you know, you probably would contest it unless you knew that they were, like, best pals. But the will upheld in court, and so he got that inheritance. He stayed in Eastbourne as well throughout the war, though he wasn't deemed as desirable by other doctors to be selected for a pool system. And that was where GPs would treat the patients of colleagues who had been called up to war. So he wasn't good enough for that in his colleagues' eyes. And in 1941, he ended up gaining a diploma in anaesthetics. So, you know, he could start prescribing drugs and dealing with all of that sort of thing. In 1943, his mother as well sadly passed away. Now, after years of rumours as well that Adams had, you know, unconventional methods, there was also rumours going about that he had at least 132 wills of his patients. So he'd been mentioned in 132 wills. Now, on the 23rd of July 1956, Eastbourne police received an anonymous call about a death. It was from Leslie Henson, the music hall performer whose friend Gertrude Hullett had died unexpectedly while being treated by Dr. Adams. Now, the investigation was taken over from Eastbourne Police by two officers from the Metropolitan Police's murder squad. The senior officer was Detective Superintendent Herbert Hannam of Scotland Yard, and he was assisted by a junior officer, Detective Sergeant Charles Hewitt. The investigation focused on cases from 1946 to 1956 only. I say only, but that's a span of 10 years. Of the 300...
That's still a huge amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Of the 310 death certificates examined by the Home Office pathologist, Francis Camps, 163 were deemed to be suspicious. Again, big odds. Don't have to do higher maths, Caitlin, to figure that one out. Many were given special injections, or should I say in quotes, special injections, of substances Dr. Adams refused to describe to the nurses caring for his patients. Furthermore, it emerged that his habit was to ask the nurses to leave the room before injections were given. Now, on the 24th of August, in 1956, Hannam started to encounter problems. Now, the British Medical Association sent a letter to all doctors in Eastbourne reminding them of patient confidentiality if interviewed by the police. So obviously the detective was not impressed by this, and the Attorney General, Sir Reginald Manningham Buller, who prosecuted all cases of poisoning, he wrote to the BMA secretary, Dr. McRae, to try to get him to remove this ban, because this was like saying, do not speak to the police. We have client confidentiality, kind of like, you know, how lawyers do as well. Now, the impasse continued for months until the 8th of November. Manningham Buller met with Dr. McRae and, amazingly, passed him Hannam's 187-page report on Dr. Adams to convince him of the importance of the case. So again, this is a secure report just getting passed about. Dr. McRae took the report to the president of the BMA and returned it the next day, but very likely took copies of it and passed it all around to the defence team. Now, Dr. McRae then contacted doctors in Eastbourne himself and told them that they had no information which would justify the charges against Adams. So only two Eastbourne doctors ever gave evidence to the police. Detective Hannam ended up actually bumping into Dr. Adams on the 1st of October 1956, and Dr. Adams asked him that if he was finding all of these rumours untrue. Aren't you? Hannam mentioned a prescription that he had forged, and Adam's response was just that: it was very wrong. I have God's forgiveness for it. Hannam brought up the deaths of Adams's patients and his receipts of legacies from them, you know, because there's bloody tons of them. And Dr. Adams answered that a lot of these were instead of fees. I don't want money. What use is it? For someone that doesn't want money, he's got a lot of it.
I can tell you the use of it, hon.
Yes. Now, on the 24th of November, Hannam and a detective inspector, Pugh, searched Adams's house with a warrant issued under the Dangerous Drugs Act 1951. Adams was surprised because he was like, you're not going to find anything. Now, Hannam asked for Adams's dangerous drugs register, which is the record of those ordered and used, because remember on a previous case of the poisoner, I think it was Kate, back in the day, again, Victorian times, just pure buying a load of mental stuff over the counter.
Yep.
This act was introduced. And then remember, if you were to go buy something, you had to put your name on there. You had to sign it, date it. You also, I believe, if you were a doctor or someone in the profession of where you're going to be obtaining these drugs, you had to keep a register of what you bought, who you given it to, the amounts, etc. Big proper files here. But he didn't know what he meant. He didn't keep a record, and he hadn't kept one, in fact, since 1949. So, great. During the search, Adams opened a cupboard and slipped something into his pocket. He was challenged by the police to show them, but he was like, okay. And it was two bottles of morphine. One, he said, was for a Mrs. Annie Sharp, a patient and major witness who had died 9 days earlier under his care. And the other was for a Mr. Sodden, who died on the 17th of September, 1956. Though pharmacy records later showed that Mr. Sodden had never been prescribed morphine. So he's lying. He was later, after his trial, not to ruin anything, he is obviously going to go to trial for this, but Adams was later convicted of obstructing the search, concealing the bottles, and for failing to keep a dangerous drugs register. So, you know, he did end up getting in trouble for this. Now, he was asked as well, why did you do it? And Adams just said that, you know, easing the passing of a dying person, it's not that wicked. People want to die and they can't be murdered. It's impossible to accuse a doctor, which I'm all for assisted dying. Like, I do believe in it, like dignitas and all that.
That's a really difficult one. Yeah. Because if they were, like, if he is saying that they were genuinely on their deathbeds and in pain or whatever, then I do understand that. But were they?
No, I don't believe they were. And this was his excuse. But yeah. Now, in December 1956, the police acquired a memorandum belonging to a Daily Mail journalist concerning rumours of homosexuality between a police officer, a magistrate and a doctor. Like, it does kind of sound like the start of a joke, you know, like an Englishman, Scotsman and Irishman walk into a bar. But yeah. Now, the latter directly implied Dr. Adams, so he was the doctor. This information had come, according to the reporter, directly from Hannam. The magistrate was Sir Roland Gwynne, mayor of Eastbourne from 1929 to 1931, and brother of Rupert Gwynne, who was an MP for Eastbourne from 1910 to 1924. Gwynne was Adams's patient and known to visit every morning at 9 a.m. They went on frequent holidays together as well and had just spent 3 weeks in Scotland that September. The police officer was none other than the chief constable of Eastbourne, so chief constable of Eastbourne, Richard Walker. Due to this connection, though, Hannam spent kind of little time pursuing this line of inquiry, because if there's a police officer involved, they ain't going to go down that rabbit hole, are they? Despite homosexuality being, it was an offence back in 1956. Now, you may think as well, why on earth are you mentioning it, Samantha, if there's no investigation and it's not really relevant what he did in his spare time? Like, because it's not. However, it does show that Dr. Adams had pretty close friendships with those in high places with power in Eastbourne at that time. And we know that people in high places can get away with pretty much anything. Now, on the 19th of December 1956, Dr. Adams was arrested, by which time he'd become the richest doctor in England. He ended up even paying £1,100 surtax in 1955 alone. So, a side note, surtax, it was an extra tax paid by people who earn more than a particularly large amount. It was abolished in the UK in 1973, but it was replaced by higher income tax rates. So, it's just higher rate. He was a higher rate taxpayer. Now, when told of the charges, Dr. Adams said, "Murder. Murder? Can you prove it was murder? I didn't think you could prove it was murder. She was dying in any event." Then, while he was being taken away from Kent Lodge, he gripped his receptionist's hands and told her that he would see her in heaven. So, quite a strange one there. Now, Hannam collected enough evidence in at least four of the cases for prosecution to be warranted regarding Clara Neil Miller, Julia Bradnam, Edith Alice Morell, and Gertrude Hullett. Of these, Adams was charged on just two counts, the murder of Morell and Hullett. Now, I'll go on and tell you about them both in a moment. The committal hearing took place in Lewes on the 14th of January 1957. The chairman of the magistrates was Sir Roland Gwynne, but he stepped down, obviously due to his close friendship with Adams. The hearing concluded on the 24th of January, and after a five-minute deliberation, Adams was committed for trial. The trial started on the 18th of March 1957 at the Old Bailey. 3 days later as well, a new Homicide Act came into effect, which was murder by poison became a non-capital effect, because at that time it was a capital offence and you could be tried for murder. But because it was 3 days after, Adams would still face the death penalty if he was found guilty.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Now, on to Edith Alice Morrill. One of Adams's patients that he was charged with the murder was Edith, who was a wealthy widow. She had suffered from a stroke, was partially paralysed and had severe arthritis. In 1949, she'd moved to Eastbourne and came under Dr. Adams's supervision. He supplied her with doses of heroin and morphine to ease her symptoms of cerebral irritation and to help her sleep. During the trial, it was established that in the 10 months before her death, Adams had given her total way above beyond the amount of barbiturates. I can't read medication at all, apart from really paracetamol.
I was like, I don't know what this is. Yeah. He gave them some high paracetamol.
Yeah, paracetamol and ibuprofen, that's all I can pronounce. Sordamid, morphine and heroin. Between the 7th and 12th of November 1949 alone, she was given 40 grains of morphine, which is 2,624 milligrams, and 39 grains of heroin, which is 2,527 milligrams of that, according to her prescriptions. Now, this would more than likely have been enough to kill her in itself, despite any tolerance developed. Now, that's just mental, because apparently between 375,
yeah, that is
a shit ton. Yeah, so yeah, either way, that's way more than what your body is supposed to be able to take. Morrill had made several wills, and in some of them Adams received large sums of money or furniture, in others, but also in other wills as well, he wasn't mentioned at all. Now, on the 24th of August 1949, she added a codicil saying that Adams would receive nothing, which codicil is an extra part of your will, to kind of like an update. Despite Morrill's clause, 3 months later, aged 81, on the 13th of November 1950, she died from a stroke, according to Adams. Now, despite Morrill's clause, you know, the codicil, the doctor received a small amount of her £78,000 estate, though he did receive less than one of the nurses and also less than one of her chauffeurs. He did receive a Rolls-Royce Silver Ghost valued at £1,500. Again, his love of cars, he clearly wasn't going to reject this one. And an antique chest containing silver cutlery worth £276, which Adams had often told her that he admired. After her death, he took away an infrared lamp as well that she had bought herself, which was worth £60, and it was later found in his surgery. So he just thought, well, I'll take that. The day after her death, Adams arranged for Morrill to be cremated. And on the cremation form, he stated that, as far as I'm aware, he had no monetary interest in the death of the deceased. This falsehood, therefore, avoided the necessity of a post-mortem. That same evening, Morrill's ashes were scattered over the English Channel. So this screams Harold Shipman in a way, you know, going to kill someone, they will be burned and cremated right away and we're going to get rid of all the evidence. Now,
yeah, that's what I was thinking. I was like, oh, I don't know if you were going to start talking about like exhuming bodies and stuff, but obviously, no.
Yeah, you can't exhume a body if there's not a body. Anyway, now on the 23rd of July 1956, Gertrude Hullett, another of Adams's patients who he was being charged for her murder, died aged 50. She had been depressed since the death of her husband 4 months earlier and had been prescribed large amounts of sodium barbitone and also sodium phenobarbitone. She had told Adams on frequent occasions of her wish to kill herself. On the 19th of July, most likely, she took an overdose and was found the next morning in a coma. Adams was unavailable and a Dr. Harris attended, with Adams arriving later in the day. Not once during their discussion did Adams mention her depression or her medication. They decided a cerebral hemorrhage was most likely due to partly contracted pupils. This, however, is also a symptom of morphine or barbiturate poisoning. Moreover, her breathing was shallow, typical of an overdose-induced coma. A cerebral hemorrhage is usually accompanied by heavy breathing. Dr. Shera, a pathologist, was called to take a spinal fluid sample on the 20th of July. He immediately asked if her stomach contents should also be examined in case of narcotic poisoning. Adams and Harris both opposed this. The result of a urine sample taking showed Hullett had 115 grains of sodium barbitone in her body, twice the fatal dose. These results were only received on the 23rd after her death. The coroner at Hullett's inquest definitely thought that poisoning should have been considered earlier. In fact, on the 22nd, Adams admitted the possibility of barbiturate poisoning and gave Hullett a newly developed antidote, 10cc of megamide. The recommended dose in the instructions, as the inquest established, was 100cc to 200cc. Adams had even checked with a colleague at the Princess Alice Hospital in Eastbourne, who told police he had told Adams to give doses of 1cc every 5 minutes. He had then given Adams 100cc of megamide. The coroner described Adams's treatment as merely a gesture. He also questioned why Adams only gave oxygen to the patient just hours before she died. The nurse had described Hullett as cyanosed, which, you know, blue. Adams responded that there didn't seem to be any kind of necessity for oxygen. The coroner then asked why there had been no intravenous drip, and he answered that she wasn't perspiring, she had lost no fluid, so why would you put a drip on? But the nurse, however, described Hullett as sweating a good deal from the 20th of July to her death. The inquest decided Hullett committed suicide. The jury were directed by the coroner not to find that Hullett died as a result of Adams' criminal negligence. After the inquest, but before the trial in 1957, the DPP's office compiled a table of patients treated with megamide and dapsazole for barbiturate poisoning at St Mary's Hospital in Eastbourne between May 1955 and February 1957. 17 patients were listed, 15 had recovered, and 6 of those had been in the first half of 1956, before Hullett's death. All but one had been put on a drip, and several had taken a higher dose than Hullett. Most importantly, however, Adams had worked at this hospital for one day a week since 1941, when he had qualified as an It was presumed by the DPP, therefore, that he must have heard of these cases and their successful treatment. So why did an overdose not cross his mind? And why did he provide delayed and inaccurate treatment if he knew all about this? It's also worth noting as well that Adams called the pathologist to make an appointment for the post-mortem before Hullett had even died. Now, the pathologist obviously was, like, shocked, and he accused Adams of extreme incompetence. Hullett left her 1954 Rolls-Royce Silver Dawn worth at least £2,900 to Adams in a will dated the 14th of July. Adams changed the car's registration on the 8th of December, and then he sold it on the 13th. He was arrested on the 20th of December. Adams had also received a cheque for £1,000 from Hullett on the 17th of July, which was 6 days before her death. He took it to the bank the next day and was told it would clear by the 21st. He then asked for it to be specially cleared to credit his account the next day. This was quite an unusual request back then, because special clearance was mostly given in cases where a cheque might bounce. But Hullett was one of the richest residents in Eastbourne, so obviously this was not going to bounce, but they did it either way. Now, the cheque was then lost during the investigation. Now, Adams was first tried for the murder of Mrs. Morrell. Defence counsel Sir Frederick Geoffrey Lawrence, QC, which was a specialist in real estate and divorce cases, he was never really in criminal court, so I don't know why he was doing it. And this was him defending his first murder trial. He ended up convincing the jury that there was no evidence that a murder had even been committed, much less that a murder had been committed by Dr. Adams. He emphasised that the indictment was based mainly on testimonies from the nurses who tended Mrs. Morrell, and that none of the witnesses' evidence matched the others. Also, only one of the prosecution's two expert medical witnesses were prepared to say that murder had definitely been committed, and Lawrence was able to to demonstrate that he was not a reliable witness, so he was thrown out. Adams did not appear in the witness box either. He was not given any evidence. The prosecution was not allowed to produce evidence from Gertrude Hullett's case, and therefore a nurse who had worked with Adams in caring for Hullett was unable to take the stand. Adams was found not guilty on the 15th of April 1957. So he got away with this.
I was waiting for you to say, however,
it is crazy. So after all of this and everything I've just said to you, Adams was found not guilty. Now, there's a considerable evidence to suggest that the trial was interfered with by outside forces. Now, also remember, he's a powerful person. He has powerful friends. So is this why he's gotten away with it? Or... Was he just not guilty? Maybe he wasn't.
I always find it difficult, though, if people have got friends in high places.
Mm-hmm. Now, the nurse's notebooks as well, these were vital pieces of evidence. 8 books of records made by nurses who had worked under Dr. Adams were recorded in pre-trial police records, but they disappeared before the trial started, which meant that Sir Reginald Manningham Buller, he couldn't familiarise himself with them. He was presented with only one copy of them, but the defence on the second day of the trial. These books were then used by the fully prepared defence to counter evidence given against Adams by the nurses who had originally written all the notes. Now, 6 years after the event, the notes could be said to be more reliable than the nurses' own memories, because obviously they would be, you forget things after 6 years. Now, the defence was not required to explain how the books came into their hands because they were never given them, and the Attorney General made no effort to pursue this matter. Despite his nickname, this was the Reginald Manningham Buller, his nickname was Sir Bullying Manor. So, you know, if he was he was quite a rude man, and if he didn't agree with you, he didn't agree with you. He was quite a bully in a way. But if you were to go against him, you weren't going to win. Now, Adams gave 3 conflicting explanations for how the defence came to have the notebooks. They were either given to him by Mrs. Morrell's son when he found them among her effects and filed away at his surgery. Now, why would they be in her house? Who knows? They were delivered anonymously to his door after she died. They were found in the air raid shelter at the back of his garden. So 3 different stories of how these books came to his hands. His solicitor later claimed that they were found by the defence team in Adams' surgery shortly before trial. So all of this differs from the police records, however. In the list of exhibits for the committal hearing given to the DPP's office, they were clearly mentioned before all of this. Now, the Attorney General, therefore, must have known that they existed. Now, on the 8th of November 1956, the Attorney General handed a copy of Hanman's report as well. Again, like I said earlier, that report was given to the kind of trade union, the British Medical Association, you know, to get them to be able to speak to the police and all that jazz. Again, all these copies would have been passed around. Now, the NHS, again, that was founded in 1948. But by 1956, the time of the trial, it was so stretched financially to breaking point and doctors were kind of disaffected. The Royal Commission on Doctors' Pay was set up in February 1957. So a doctor sentence to death would have been the final straw. It would turn doctors away from wanting to work for the NHS because they'd think that, oh, well, we could be hanged for prescribing medication. And it would ruin public confidence in this whole service that has been set up. So again, was he not found guilty because they didn't want to ruin the NHS? Now, it's worth noting as well that there was parts of this trial, all of the records, was Scotland Yard's file on the case were closed until 2033. Now, this is an unusual decision. Yeah, considering the advanced age of the suspect and the witnesses and all of the others involved, the files were only open, though, before 2033. They were open 30 years previous in 2003 because special permission was granted. Now, again, if this guy's innocent, why were they closed for such a long period of time? Now, there's also quite a lot of other evidence and testimonies that were brought by the detective, but he couldn't put these into court. Now, on the 23rd of February 1950, he had a patient called Amy Ware, and she died at the age of 76. Now, Adams had actually banned her from seeing her relatives prior to her death. She left Adams £1,000 of her total estate, and yet he got her cremation form, and that said that there was no other beneficiaries of the will, and then just went on with his life. 28th of December 1950, there was an Annabel Kilgour, died aged 89. Again, she'd been attended by Adams since July when she had had a stroke. She went into a coma on the 23rd of December, immediately after Adams started giving her sedatives. The nurse involved later told the police she was quite certain Adams either gave the wrong injection or far too concentrated of a type. She left Adams £200 and an expensive clock. On the 3rd of January 1952, Adams purchased 5,000 phenobarbital tablets, but by the time his house was searched 4 years later, none were left. So he's given out 5,000 tablets in the space of 4 years. Now, there's more testimonies as well from patients, elderly patients, that ended up kind of like a theme. They died the age of 70, 80, 90, left him money, left him cars, left him jewellery, clocks, etc. Yet they were cremated and life went on for Dr. Adams. Now,
Jesus.
in the aftermath of the trial, Adams did resign from the National Health Service and he was convicted later that year on 8 counts of forging prescriptions, 4 counts of making false statements on cremation forms, and 3 offences under the Dangerous Drugs Act 1951. So that's what I mentioned previously. He was convicted for a bunch of things, just not murder. But for this, he was fined £2,400 plus all the costs that kind of, the court costs. And on the 22nd of November 1957, he was then struck off the medical register. Adams then went on to sell his story to the Daily Express for £10,000, and he successfully sued several newspapers for libel because, again, this was huge. This was huge in the press. People were printing off things. It was like, Dr. Murder and everything. And it was like the usual. When press get a good byline, they are running with it. You are guilty before you've even went to trial when the newspapers get involved, as we know. However, this guy sued them. Now, he stayed in Eastbourne despite the common belief that he had murdered 21 people. And it's worth noting as well that the belief, it wasn't generally shared by his friends and patients. Like, they didn't believe that he was guilty. There was one exception, though, was Roland Gwynn. He ended up distancing himself considerably from Adams after the trial. So he possibly had doubts. He was reinstated, though, as a general practitioner in 1961, after 2 failed applications of trying to get it before then. So he was struck off in
No.
1957. 4 years later, he's back as being a GP. So he was allowed to resume his medical career. And so that just kind of means that his professional colleagues mustn't have found him guilty of murder or
Wow.
gross negligent or incompetent. Like, how is just beyond me. Now, he also ended up applying for a visa to America. To move to America or flee to America, who knows, in August 1962. But this was refused because he had a dangerous drug conviction, which I'm sure is still like the case now. If you've got anything on your like record, you are not getting into America, which, yeah. Adams later became a president and honorary medical officer of the British Clay Pigeon Shooting Association. So this was his life sort of thing. Now, he did apps like this is also relevant. He was into British clay pigeon shooting, and Adams later slipped and fractured his hip on the 30th of June 1983 while shooting in Battle, which is in East Sussex. So he was out with the clay pigeons. He slipped, hurt his hip. He was taken to Eastbourne Hospital, but when there, he developed a chest infection and he died on the 4th of July 1983 of left ventricular failure. He left an estate of £402,970 because he had been receiving legacies from all of those other death patients that had died until the very end. So it's as
Jesus.
well later thought that he could have killed up to 163 patients. He was found guilty of none of it. Was he the first adult shipment, or
Oh.
did he actually just want to assist people who wanted to die?
Oh,
I don't believe
that's
he did want to assist people. I think he was a murderer and he wanted all the money in that. But again, I could be wrong, and that is just my opinion.
That's so difficult.
Yeah.
I think he was. I think it's the same. I think he was a murderer. But then the fact he was never found guilty,
Yeah.
that's insane.
But again, was he not found guilty because he had friends in high places, or was he not found guilty because he wasn't guilty? Let us know. If you
Oh,
haven't a
that's
thought on
so
it, yeah.
hard.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, it'd be good to know what other people's thoughts are, because I'd like to say yes, but then, oh, I don't know.